As Tesla and big car makers like GM and Nissan gear up to bring electric cars to the masses, it's worth noting that electric cars have been on the road for decades. Reporter Krista Almanzon of member station KAZU visited a company called Electro Auto in California's Santa Cruz Mountains. For more than three decades, it's been teaching people how to convert their conventional cars into plug-ins.
I appreciate the functionality of cars, but I'm not the type to eagerly await my turn to get behind the wheel of something new. But this is different. Okay. It's a gold 1984 VW Rabbit, and it's electric.
You want to drive it?
Yeah, I'll give it a shot. I'm crammed in this tiny car with three guys, but some quick maneuvering lands me in the very quiet driver's seat.
So is it on?
Yeah, it's on. You just have to take off the parking brake.
And off we go onto the streets of the small Santa Cruz Mountains town of Felton.
Yeah, it's just like driving a normal car.
Yeah.
Any of these guys will tell you that's pretty much the point.
You have the hardware for this side?
Just days ago, they converted the gas Rabbit to electric in this hands-on workshop.
I'm guessing this is the charging plug.
The Rabbit is getting an electric motor that will run on the same batteries used in golf carts, 18 of them.
We're putting the back supports for this rack here, which holds 8 batteries, 4 up here and 4 down across the front.
That's Mike Brown. His company, Electro Automotive, has been in the electric car conversion business since 1979. It was the first to sell parts for gas to electric conversions. Now he also teaches these classes.
The market we focused on was the grocery getter. The mission statement or the job description for that gold Rabbit out there, it had to haul 4 adults and a load of groceries.
The short commute market is a natural fit for electric car conversions because these cars do have limitations, the biggest being how far the car can go on one battery charge. Sherry Prangy is Brown's wife and business partner. She says range can vary from 20 miles to 100 plus. It can depend on the car and its amenities.
If you're using accessories like air conditioning, or if you've got four-wheel drive, that's going to use more energy. If you want a really hot acceleration car, that's using more energy, just like it uses more gas.
And that's the challenge a business like Electro Auto will face from the growing electric market. Bill Moore publishes the online electric vehicle magazine EV World. He says what the Nissan Leaf will have over gas conversions is it was built to be an electric car.
This thing's going to drive just like any car. If you got into a Nissan Versa, it's going to have all of the function and features that you would expect in a conventional gasoline car. The only limit being it'll only go as far as its batteries will carry it.
Nissan puts the range at 100 miles. Still, back at the Electro Auto Workshop, student and former airplane mechanic Daniel Markham says he'd rather build his own.
This way I could probably modify it exactly the way I want it.
He says he'll take what he learned working on this conversion back home to Hawaii. He expects to spend about $20,000 to convert a Porsche, though some DIY conversions can be done for as little as $9,000.
It's not about saving money. It's about having an electric vehicle for my enjoyment as well as doing good for the environment.
Sherry and Mike know the emerging electric car market can take a bite out of their business, but it can also help their business grow because it increases awareness.
We are no longer a bunch of hairball freaks on the fringe.
And while major manufacturers may not say so, EV World's Bill Moore credits the fringe electric car enthusiasts for keeping the technology alive. For NPR News, I'm Krista Almanzon in the Santa Cruz Mountains.
An unusual public school in New York City is using a video game as its model for how to teach and for what kids should know. The school, called Quest to Learn, is wrapping up its first year. Heather Chaplin reports on how it has implemented the idea that playing and designing video games is part of 21st century literacy.
Video games don't come with instructions, but have you ever seen a kid not figure out how to play? Something about video games turns kids into phenomenal learners. Katie Salen wanted to harness this power.
The big idea of the school is that we looked at how games work, literally how they're built, and the way they support learning. And we thought, could we design a school from the ground up that supported learning in the way that games do?
This idea has been advocated for years by scholar James G., one of Salen's mentors. They believe video games are key to a new kind of literacy for the 21st century.
In math, we're traveling around the world.
That's sixth grader Rocco Rose, a student at Quest to Learn and a citizen of Creepy Town, an imaginary city where his class learns math and English. Right now, they're travel agents, converting currencies, keeping blogs about their travel experiences, and budgeting trips.
So you wouldn't be able to go to Tokyo, you wouldn't be able to go to Athens without actually opening up that vault.
Creepy Town is structured like a video game that's jumped out of the computer. Katie Salen explains the kids have 10-week missions culminating in a boss level.
The second trimester, Creepy Town went broke. They had like an economic crisis, and so the kids looked at all their receipts to figure out, well, what went wrong, and then they proposed the design of a theme park to bring revenue in, so they designed a
Creepy Town, like a video game, is a complex dynamic system, a model that changes depending on what the player does. Salen says playing with complex dynamic systems gives kids opportunities to learn.
To learn how to solve problems, how to communicate, how to use data, how to begin to predict things that might be coming down the line.
They also learn something called systems thinking, which Salen says is one of the cornerstones of 21st century literacy. It helps you understand how, say, the behavior of a derivatives trader in Hong Kong affects housing prices in Florida. When a system becomes sufficiently complex, Salen says, you start to get outcomes that are hard to foresee.
Suddenly you begin to get what's called emergent behavior. And in emergent behavior, that system, the elements in it begin to relate to each other in ways that can be unpredictable.
In a classroom across the hall from Creepy Town, 12-year-old Liam Smith is working with his team to storyboard one of Aesop's fables. It's the first step of the game design process. At Quest to Learn, students not only play in game-like environments, they also make video games. Salen says there's no better way to learn systems thinking than making one. It's also familiar, says Liam.
When you start playing games at age 3, I think it just comes naturally to you.
For parents, though, video games aren't necessarily so familiar. Sam Clayton said choosing to send his child to Quest to Learn was a difficult decision.
Getting involved with the school, since there has been no program previously existing quite like this, that it was a complete leap of faith getting involved and like jumping off a bridge.
Kids at Quest to Learn do take the same standardized tests as all public school kids. Valerie Shute has a grant to assess the school from the MacArthur Foundation, which put up the seed money for Quest to Learn.
The school's under a huge microscope right now, and there's a lot of people that are hoping for, you know, a wild success and other people hoping for the opposite.
Shute says she's optimistic traditional skills like math won't take a beating. For Katie Salen, the bottom line of 21st century literacy is empowerment.
What systems thinking does is it simply gives you a tool to manage complexity. Because of the complexity of problems, if you're not able to look at them as a system, you're just going to look at a blur. You will just be overwhelmed by the complexity.
The school has around 500 applicants for 85 slots in next year's class, so Creepy Town will be thriving for at least one more year. For NPR News, I'm Heather Chaplin.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Ira Flatow. Time now for Flora. Well, hi, Flora.
Hi.
Flora Lichtman's video pick of the week. She's here with our video pick. It's another great one.
Thanks,
what,
Ira.
What have you got for us this week?
It's this little meet and greet with a telescope you may not be familiar with yet. The successor to the Hubble is the James Webb Space Telescope, and it hasn't been launched yet. It's due up in 2014. Mm-hmm. But as part of its sort of coming out party, I think, NASA's kind of been parading around this full-scale model all over the world. It's been to Munich and Dublin, Seattle.
And get those little stickers on it from all these different places.
Yeah, there's tons of pictures of people sort of like giving this giant observatory a hug.
Right.
So it came to New York, and we met up with it and talked to some of its handlers about what the James Webb is going to be doing.
It's pretty big. I mean, you have to have a good spot for it, no?
Yeah, it was in Battery Park. It was in Battery Park, which is downtown. It needs a big area because it's about the size of a tennis court.
Wow.
So think about that. This was the kind of the amazing thing about seeing it is how do you get something that is the size of a tennis court up in space a million miles away, which is where it's headed? Mm-hmm. And part of what was neat was hearing about the engineering of this device. So basically they have to fold it up like a, you know, like a flower that is going to then unfurl once it gets to its destination. But as you can imagine, there's a lot of tricky engineering in that.
Yeah, so if you go to our website at sciencefriday.com, you can see Flora's video, an interview with the folks there. and see how this almost magically is going to unfold. It's like amazing.
It is pretty amazing. And I think one of the other tricky things about building it we learned was that you have these huge mirrors, and the mirrors are it's like 8 of Hubble's optics can fit into the James Webb optic. So wow. We're talking about a lot bigger. And the James Webb, by the way, is an infrared observatory, and Hubble's visible. And what that should allow us to do is to see farther back in time. But part of this was building these giant mirrors. And they said that you actually have to shave off atoms by the end to get the...
It's so precise. You have to shave it to the atom.
That's right. It was which was unbelievable. I mean, just to get the prescription exactly right so that you focus that light into the other mirror, which then collects it and sends it.
They're not using a ShamWow on that to clean it.
No, indeed. No, and it's made of beryllium, too, because the other thing I hadn't thought about is it's pretty cold in space, it turns out, like negative 400 degrees Fahrenheit. And so they have to make it of these special materials. It sounds like that was part of the big challenge, just figuring out what material you can make a mirror out of that'll work as a mirror in those conditions.
Yeah, and I guess of course it has to keep its shape because it is a mirror, and you're going to make it a certain shape. That's why they're using that material.
Right, and they test it here on Earth. They have to sort of make it in a prescription that in room temperature is going to be a different shape that than it will be in colder temperatures. So there's a lot of sort of tricky engineering. And in fact, it took 20 years. I mean, the plans for this telescope started happening before Hubble went up.
Wow. Let's hope they don't have to put those eyeglasses on this one. I can fix it while it's here on the ground.
I think it's going to be difficult because it's headed to Lagrange point number 2. So
that's far out there.
That's pretty far.
Yeah. Well, and you can see this James Webb telescope out there. The floor went out there with a camera and interviewed folks at Battery Park here in New York. Go to our website at sciencefriday.com, a video pick of the week up there in the left side. Click on it and click on a bigger section of it and watch it and share it with your friends.
Please.
Thank you. Thank you, Flora.
Thanks, Ira.
Have a good weekend. That's about all the time we have for our program today. Our producers include Christopher Intagliata, senior producer Ned Heiss. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Lesha Bayak, our Spanish language producer. Neil Rausch is our technical director at the controls here in New York. Our science and arts producer is Catherine Wells. And if you missed any part of our program, go to our website at sciencefriday.com. Download our podcasts, our audio and videos. You can also go take our iPhone app, download it for instant access to Science Friday. You can watch the videos or listen to Science Friday anytime you would like on our app. And also we're tweeting at SciFry. You can join our social community there and talk to folks at our website at sciencefriday.com. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. The crude oil gushing in the Gulf of Mexico isn't only a problem when it hits beaches or fall-sensitive marshland. The floating slick offshore can make a mess of the commercial ships that traverse Gulf waters. The Coast Guard has set up dozens of offshore cleaning stations so ocean-going vessels don't track oil into shipping channels, ports, and marinas. NPR's Debbie Elliott has more.
You're on the buoy.
I'm aboard the seagoing tug, the Resolute. It's been converted into a floating decontamination station. Ships that travel through the Gulf of Mexico and become oiled have to stop at this boat and get the oil cleaned from their hulls before they're able to come into port.
We're spraying them down to make sure they're not contaminating the uncontaminated area of Mobile Bay.
Coast Guard Marine Science Technician John Revis is the pollution inspector aboard the Resolute, positioned near the entrance to the Mobile Ship Channel. The 100-foot tug would normally be docking and sailing ships in and out of Mobile Harbor, but now it's one of at least 37 offshore cleaning stations operating from Louisiana to the Florida Panhandle and paid for by BP. Revis says they're seeing all kinds of oil sticking to ships.
We'll get real sticky brown stuff on there that we can't even get off with the water cannon all the way to a real light sheen that we can spray off real quickly.
If the ships can't be sprayed off and are still trailing sheen in the water, Revis sends them to decontamination stations closer to shore that have better equipment. Mostly, Revis says, they're seeing the heavier oil, and not just on commercial vessels like the freighters and tankers that offload at the Port of Mobile. Some of the worst soiled boats are the ones now working for BP in the cleanup.
Decombo Resolute.
Resolute's on 1-1.
Yep, this is a simple man inbound here. We would like to get you to inspect my hull when you pass. I see you coming right there.
Resolute Captain Jimmy Menhennett wants the simple man, a shrimp trawler, to come a little closer.
Yeah, if you don't mind, just start easing toward me. Just get a little bit better water for me, please, sir. All right, this is mostly what we've been dealing with during the day are these shrimp boats coming in that have been out here skimming oil.
On the deck below the bridge, the Resolute crew readies to go to work. Able-bodied seaman John Mayo takes the helm of a giant red water cannon that sucks up seawater.
It's like shooting a big old squirt cannon. That's what we use to suppress fires and what we've been using to spray off the hulls of any vessels that have oil on them.
Mayo aims the high-pressure spray low, where the simple man's hull meets the water. He methodically works all the way around the boat as the captain above maneuvers the tug to avoid a bladder full of oily water the shrimp boat is towing inshore for disposal.
Nice, simple man. That's going to do it, Cap.
All right, fine. Appreciate it. Y'all have a good one.
Get that water away from that bladder.
Captain Menhennett, a Mobile native, says watching what's happening in the Gulf is sad, but that this is at least one thing he and his local crew can do to help. Debbie Elliott, NPR News, Orange Beach, Alabama.
The new iPhone 4 has people lining up at stores eager to get their hands on one. Unfortunately, those who've touched it say if your fingers hit the rim in the wrong spot, phone calls drop. NPR's Laura Seidel went to find out if it's true.
When Steve Jobs introduced the iPhone earlier this month, he bragged about the sleek steel rim that doubled as an antenna. But as soon as people got the phone, the complaints began to flood in. Users claimed that if you touched the phone just right on the left edge where there's a break in the steel rim, calls get cut off. So I wanted to find out, is it true?
So here I am at the Apple Store in downtown San Francisco, and I am going to call my editor, Sarah Saracen, and we're going to see if there's a glitch. Sarah, I'm moving my fingers around the rim. So, are you there? Are you there? It does, in fact, seem to drop out.
I tried again, just in case it was a fluke, and the same thing happened. Word is out on the street, and it's giving customers like Rue Mizuno pause about buying one.
It's definitely caught my attention, yeah. I think I'll take a look at it or wait a little bit more to hear more about it before I commit to buying the new one.
All over the web, folks are coming up with some creative high-tech solutions. Fast Company magazine recommends scotch tape in the little crack along the side. Other folks are recommending a rubber case for the phone. Apple is owning up to the problem. In a statement, the company said, gripping the phone will result in some attenuation of its antenna performance. The statement continued, this is a fact of life for every wireless phone. Steve Jobs himself responded. His answer was like the old joke about the guy who tells the doctor, doctor, it hurts when I do this. The doctor says, well, don't do that. In this case, Steve Jobs responded, well, don't do that. Laura Seidel, NPR News, San Francisco.
This is NPR.
Every president, Democratic and Republican, since Richard Nixon has vowed to strive to make the United States energy independent. 40 years later, human beings have landed on the moon, human hearts are routinely transplanted, communism has collapsed, and silicon chips have made it possible to pack a library worth of information into a device smaller than your thumb. So why hasn't the United States or any nation become energy independent? Jim Woolsey is the chairman of Woolsey Partners and a former director of Central Intelligence. He specializes in a range of alternative energy and security issues. He joins us in our studios. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Scott.
So what are some of the obstructions, technological, economic, and political?
Well, in part, we haven't been working frequently on the right problem. There are two energy systems, essentially, in the U.S. One is transportation, and that's about 70% oil. And the other is the electricity grid, and that's over half fueled by coal and then natural gas, nuclear, hydro, and others. They don't have very much to do with one another now. Back in the 70s, it was different. Oil-fired power plants provided about 20% of the country's electricity. So if you were building a nuclear power plant or a wind farm in the 70s, you could well be replacing oil directly. Mm-hmm. Today, you're not.
So when people talk about generating alternative sources of energy, and it often is things like wind or solar, that's not necessarily addressing the problem of foreign oil dependence.
It's not really addressing the problem of foreign oil dependence. No, that doesn't have much to do with it and won't for many years.
So where does that leave us?
In a way, there's been too much emphasis on the foreign side of this. Yes, we import well over half our oil now, and that's a bad thing. And we borrow $1 billion a day, essentially, to import oil. But producing the oil domestically helps solve the balance of payments problem, but that's about all it does. Mm-hmm. It will not interfere with OPEC's domination of oil. Something close to 80% of the world's proven reserves of oil are in OPEC states. And they are the low-cost producers, and they have the big reserves. So they're going to be effectively running the international oil trade and running the cartel that runs it, even if we drill more domestically. And so they're going to run the system. We have to effectively destroy oil as a strategic commodity. Not destroy oil, but destroy its strategic role, its dominance of transportation.
Well, that's why we've asked you here. It sounds attractive. How do you do it?
Well, I think you want to focus on existing infrastructure and existing vehicles, and there are several things that could be done relatively quickly. One, and the administration is doing this, I think, and various people on the Hill, encouraging moving toward electrification, particularly, I think, plug-in hybrids. Another is improving the efficiency of internal combustion engines. There are a number of startup companies that are inventing computer chips and valves and all kinds of things that you can use to modify existing engines in existing vehicles to get something like a 20-30% improvement in fuel efficiency. You can also encourage the use of biofuels generally. Require the automobile manufacturers much more rapidly than we're now requiring them to move to what's called an open standard flexible fuel vehicles. It just requires them to change the kind of plastic in the fuel line of the car and a bit of software, $40, $50 a vehicle in the manufacturing process. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, would be an extremely positive step. One reason it would be positive is that we've got a serious health risk problem from using petroleum products. The fine particulates that are carried into the atmosphere by what's called the aromatics, benzene, toluene, xylene, which is what the oil companies now use to increase octane, are highly carcinogenic. It really looks as if tens of thousands of deaths from malignancy a year and hundreds of millions of dollars in added health care costs are caused by these fine particulates, which the oil companies have a special waiver on, essentially. If you run a chemical plant, you can't put benzene, toluene, xylene into the atmosphere, but they are permitted to do it because it's from a mobile source like gasoline in a car.
People often point out you can burn oil. It's portable. That's why it's good for cars. There's a reason why people use oil.
Well, it does carry a lot of energy in a relatively small space. But at least as far as I'm concerned, that's about where its advantages stop. And there are just a number of things that are in the works that are going to give oil a real run for its money. Some of them are going to need some initial help. Mm-hmm. But I think the government role could largely be one of a Teddy Roosevelt-style trust buster, going after oil's cartel and oil's dominance of transportation to break it. Same thing happened to salt in the very early 20th century. Salt was a strategic commodity for thousands of years. It was the only way to preserve meat. Countries went to war over salt mines. at the beginning of the 20th century, the coming of the electric grids, meant that all of a sudden refrigeration and freezing was available affordably, and salt's dominance just fell apart within a relatively few years. That's what we need to do to oil. We need to make it as boring as salt is today.
Thank you, Mr. Woolsey.
Thank you.
Jim Woolsey, Chairman of Woolsey Partners and former Director of the CIA.